This is Mark Strassman, reporter for Grid World. We're about to talk to Charlie Catlett, who's the president of the Global Grid Forum, and we want to welcome him to Grid World. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
You're the outgoing president of the Global Grid Forum. You just announced that you'd be stepping down later this year. First, let's get a little bit of an idea about what the Global Grid Forum itself is. What is it?
Well, GGF is essentially a couple things. It's a standards body where the community of people that are working on grid technologies come together and develop common approaches and standards. But it's also, as the name implies, it's a gathering point for the community that brings people together that are not only interested in standards, but it also brings grid users together with people who are deploying grids, grid researchers together. It brings people together from industry and from the research world. So the two things we do are the forum, which is providing a venue for people to collaborate, and standards.
Okay, so essentially they collaborate on the standards, and then they can also collaborate on the actual deployment of the systems based on those standards.
Right. We have some groups that focus exclusively on, let's say, a particular specification, and we have other groups that aren't really working on standards at all. They're working on, for example, the application of grids in a particular domain. So we have a group that just started in Berlin earlier this month that is focused on enterprise grids and the kind of requirements that those users need, and we have others focused on, say, life sciences, people from pharmaceutical companies and the like, getting together to figure out what in their domain might be able to offer them based on what they, what sort of computing and information challenges they face.
Are there also focuses on domains in the sense of a geographical area?
Well, we do have affiliations with some of the geographical groups. For example, JP Grid in Japan or Grid Forum Korea. There's a recently started Grid Forum in the Netherlands, Dutch Grid Forum. We have relationships with them, with these kind of groups, because what they tend to do is bring people together from an educational point of view or people who are working on projects together, and so there's they tend to focus on the forum part, and they don't do standards. But we do have relationships with them, and try to support them in ways that we can, and leverage one another's work.
How big is the GGF in terms of its budget and in terms of its membership?
Well, I would say there are probably several thousand people that are involved in one way or another. We have a portal where people get together and work on the web.
You want to give out the URL?
That's forge.ggf.org.
Okay.
As in GridForge. And that's based on the SourceForge software that the open source community uses. There are about 1,200 users on active registered users on that site, which we've had up for about 6 months. At a typical GGF meeting, we'll see between 500 and 700 people, where I get the several thousand number is that's the number of people that are subscribed to one or more of our group mailing lists.
Okay. Now, to give people kind of a general background, could you distinguish between and among grid computing, high-performance computing, and supercomputing? And you want to say something about clusters in there, too? That's all right.
Sure. High-performance computing and supercomputing tend to deal with the provision of a resource that as the name implies, gives you a very high-performance computational service. So clusters and clusters are the way that people build supercomputers these days.
Right.
You know, it used to be that they would go and buy Cray computers or what have you. This is different from grid computing in that although grid computing originally came out of this community of high-performance computing people, grid computing is really trying to provide a set of technologies that allow you to combine resources in different organizations and different physical locations. Those may or may not be high-performance computers, and they may or may not be aimed at the science and engineering community. When I started with working with supercomputers, it was 1985, and we were starting up the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, or NCSA, and we bought a Cray computer. Within a few years, we were working with industry to try to introduce this technology to private industry. And the first companies we dealt with were Amoco and Eli Lilly and Schlumberger, and so the Caterpillar, the engineering companies, or the chemical companies, oil companies. But very quickly, we started working with the service sector. So we were working with Sears and Allstate and J.P. Morgan. And the same thing is happening with grid computing, whereas it started out in the science and engineering domain, it is quickly moving into the service sector. So it did start out with science and engineering and supercomputers, but these days it's like any other technology that starts to mature. It begins to be adopted in other areas as well.
Okay. Now, the name of the organization is Global Grid Forum. If you sort of parse that slightly differently, it refers to a grid that's worldwide. Is there such a thing now as a global grid, or are there regional grids, or what's the state of integration moving towards a global grid?
Well, that way of parsing GGF isn't really what we intended.
Okay.
It's a little different than what you see. I mean, there is a global internet.
Right.
It has a set of shared protocols and technologies. And grid is slightly different than that. I suppose at some point there one could think about a global grid, but we tend to think about grids as deployments of grid technology aimed at particular communities or organizations or sets of organizations. And so I think in the fullness of time, we would like for those instances of grids to be able to be connected and interoperate.
Right.
We don't generally think of a global grid in the same sense as the global internet.
So in the sense that someone doing some animation work in Burbank would call on processors in Uzbekistan to do the rendering yet.
Sure. I mean, you can imagine those kind of things happening, and that would be an application of a particular grid system on top of the internet.
Right.
Until we have, and we're moving in this direction, but until we have a really solid set of standards and services built on those standards, the notion of a global grid is still in the future.
Okay. Now, the separate grids that you were just talking about all do ride on the internet now, right?
Yes.
And do they need? What kind of impact is their existence exerting on the internet in terms of its demand essentially for more bandwidth?
Well, I think that we don't yet see, at least I'm not seeing a specific demand on the internet that you could say that's because the people are building grids.
Right.
But as we move this technology forward, we are going to see some impact. The project that I work on in my day job is the TerraGrid project, which is a National Science Foundation funded project.
Say more about TerraGrid.
The TerraGrid, so in that project we have a dedicated network that is each of the core sites. There are five core sites, and each of those sites has a 30 gigabit per second pipe into the site from a private backplane network that goes between.
And that backplane network can transmit at 30 gigabytes.
Well, the backplane is 40, but each of the sites connect at 30.
Okay.
So in that network, we most of the computers that are in grids, including ours, have the fastest that you can get in and out of a single computer. That's 1 gigabit per second. So in order to use the 30 that we've got, we've got to do essentially parallel streams.
Right.
And we do that. We've gotten 26 gigabits per second out of 30.
Right.
But we don't have yet a turnkey data movement service that we can give to the users. I'd say we're probably a couple months away from that. And once that sort of thing is in place, then I think we may see some impact of at least the data movement part of grids on the Internet.
Now, does the technology exist to more widely disseminate that kind of speed, and it's just a matter of customers asking for it? Or do they have to be some new breakthroughs?
Yeah, the technology is there, and more we are seeing regions and states and countries putting in the infrastructure that you need to get 10 gigabits per second, for example, or more into a particular site. When we started the TerraGrid project, and this was about 3 years ago, and we looked at what sort of network capability we would need to put these, we had at the time 4 supercomputers we were going to connect. We tried to go for as much bandwidth as we could get because we wanted to eliminate the distance factors of moving data.
Right.
And so we did this as a joint project with Qwest Communications, and so they provided our Los Angeles to Chicago piece. State of Illinois provided the fiber and equipment in Illinois to connect Argonne and CSA, and then we did some partnering with the state of California and several other entities to get the West Coast, the Caltech and San Diego Supercomputer Center connected. But in regions of the U.S., people are now deploying their own fiber networks, and so we're not very far away from the point of a campus or a laboratory being able to routinely provide a 10 gigabit per second pipe or one or more of those in and out of their site into other sites. There's a national effort called National Lambda Rail that is a consortium of universities and laboratories that are building a nationwide network to provide that sort of capability now.
Okay, now all this toing and froing of bits, what's the expected outcome? What are the benefits that are expected to be derived from building this structure?
Well, originally we thought in terms of how long it would take to get my data from here to there.
Right.
So if I, to use your earlier example, if I was making a movie or a visualization and I wanted to use some rendering processor power somewhere else, I wouldn't want to wait 3 or 4 days for my data to go back and forth.
Right.
So we thought in terms of let's get data from here to there faster. And one of the things we're looking at now is maybe with a network this fast, you don't have to move your data at all. You just remotely access it. So there are times when we might essentially like mounting a file system over a network, we might just give access to data over a network like this.
How would that work? How would that be different than sending the data?
Well, you're still sending the data, but you're just sending it as you need it. Typically today, people are sending around large sets of files.
Right.
And you might only need a piece of the data that's within that file, but you send the whole file because that's the unit of data that you work with. Some of the people within the TerraGrid project that we're working with are deploying large database engines, and so you could imagine that in the same way that I can go to somewhere and host my web page and some pictures of my family, I could go to one of these grid database services and host an entire data set as a database, in which case people would be able to query my data over the network and just get the pieces they want, as opposed to moving my whole data set and then looking through it locally.
Okay. What's the relationship between using the grid for scientific computing and using it for enterprise computing? What are the particular requirements of each, and how well suited for carrying those out is the grid model?
Well, the communities that have been using grid technology for the longest time are the more adventurous scientific communities, physics communities and chemistry and life sciences. And more and more we're seeing the commercial applications start to look at grid technologies, but still the commercial applications, the database or transaction applications, tend to think about grids as within a particular machine room. And so oftentimes they mix the they're saying grid, but they're actually talking about a cluster.
Right.
Nevertheless, they're looking at distributed systems and how to combine resources. They're just starting within a particular room.
Now, it's my understanding that grid computing works best when it has to essentially do the same thing to a lot of data over and over again. And transactional computing doesn't necessarily fit that model, and therefore it's easier to model cloud behavior than it is to process a million checks. Is that right, or to what extent is that intrinsic in the whole situation, and to what extent is that changing if it is?
Well, they're certainly different. I mean, it's different to do a computational simulation, and whether you're doing a simulation of a cloud or of a financial market,
right.
You're dealing with a self-contained system that you're creating as you go forward with a simulation. Transactions like database transactions or financial transactions they're certainly different because it's not a closed system. I think though that when you look at the need to process data, whether it's financial data or scientific data, the things that you're looking for are, I want to be able to take this chunk of data and do something to it. And if I can find a local resource to process that data, that's great. If I can find one over on the other side of my corporate network or of the internet to process the data faster, then that's so much the better. So whether that data is scientific data or financial data, I think that the needs are very similar. I think there's a misconception about scientific data that it's perhaps more tolerant to reliability or delay or security issues, and I think that's largely not the case. So whether you're looking at commercial or scientific applications, you're looking for something that's very reliable, and so you're looking for grid technology or local computing technology that can provide you with fault tolerance and things like that. These are hard to do over distributed systems, but you're also looking at security issues that are very very similar in both worlds.
How important are security issues in grid computing, and how well are they being taken care of, in your opinion?
Well, they're extremely important, and what we're seeing as people are deploying grid systems is that it's a lot more complicated to deal with being part of a grid than it is just being a node on the internet. In the sense that if I'm part of a grid system, then I'm sharing a user base with several other places, maybe four or five other places, or maybe dozens of other places. And so a security problem at one of the sites on the grid that I'm working on, whether it's my site or someone else's site, is going to affect all the members of that grid system.
So a grid is only as secure as its weakest link.
Well,
to update a cliche.
In some sense, I think that's probably true. What people are trying to do to deal with that is to look at how they can make their site secure, even though they're part of a grid with other sites.
So presumably the standards that you're working on also heavily include security standards. And
yes, there's a lot of work. In fact, this is an area where the GGF is, there's a lot of collaboration between the GGF and the Internet Engineering Task Force, where Internet standards come from, to get the security piece right. But a lot of it is also non-technical stuff. We, as with lots of security, the real problems are process and humans in the loop,
right?
And operational problems.
Who has passwords, among other things?
Well, yeah. I mean, so we use public key technology between to do single sign-on to all the sites in the Terra grid, and most grid projects are taking that approach, but even using that technology, although the technology is certainly secure, the problem becomes the same as a problem you have on non-grid systems, and that is, what if somebody breaks into your system and sniffs your password or watches people's passwords come over the network at some point where they're vulnerable? It may not be within the grid, but it may be between an end user and the grid system. And the process and the human factors are the tough part. We were working with I guess to protect the innocent, I won't talk about specific sites, but we were working with a site that had a break-in that was part of a grid.
Right.
And everybody within that grid system had to look at the users that were part of that grid system and make sure that all those users had reset their passwords, because it was a situation where passwords had been sniffed. And all it took was one user that didn't reset their password for the break-in to happen, for the people to come back and break in again.
Right. Now, I interviewed David Agrarok at Intel yesterday. He's a principal engineer and security architect for their Legrand technology and trusted computing, chair of the trusted computing group, work group for trusted platform module. Is the trusted computing initiative going to add anything to grid computing, and is it actively cooperating with grid to create trusted grids?
Well, there are a number of, that's one, and there are a number of approaches that people are trying to take, and I don't track them all myself, but in that community, that tends to be a community of people that interact and talk more than other places where there are parallel efforts.
Right.
I'm not familiar with the Trusted Computing Initiative that you talked about in detail.
Okay. Well, maybe I'd like to maybe get the two of you together so you end up with Trusted Grid.
Sure. I'll be surprised if there aren't people from Intel that are involved in some of the GGF groups.
Right.
And or the IETF groups.
Okay. Say just a little bit about who the main players in the grid world are: government agencies, scientific organizations, technology companies that provide the hardware and software, and how they interact in the creation of specific grids or the grid movement in general.
Okay, so the landscape is there are groups of technology suppliers, and these would include the companies that build software systems, and also some of the software providers that come from the public sector, so the Globus project, for example, or the Condor project. In Europe, there's the Unicor project. So there are, and most of these projects that are from the public sector also work with one or more companies and get their technology into commercial products. So there are grid technology suppliers out there. There are several kinds of consumers. One are the companies that are deploying grids and the federal agencies that are funding deployments of grids in the private and public sector, respectively. And so that there's a one level of consumer, which are the people that are building grid systems out of these software products and tools.
Right.
And then there's the second type of consumer, which is the end user that's trying to use these deployed grids. There's also so there's two kinds of consumers. There's the producers, and then I guess that'd be it. Those be the three.
Okay. And where does GGF and its standards building process come in to sort of weave together what everyone's doing?
Well, what we try to do is weave is a good word. We try to weave these communities together, first of all, by getting them physically together three times a year. And what they do is they focus in working groups and research groups. We have research groups let me start with the working groups. So the heart of what we're doing in GGF is developing common approaches and standards. And so we have working groups that are working on specifications or frameworks. So a specification, for example, would be the the Open Grid Services Infrastructure, OGSI specification, that has recently been migrated or in the process of being migrated into a set of web services, the Web Services Resource Framework and Web Services Notification. So that's an example of a specification. Another example of a specification would be Grid FTP, which is FTP extensions that allow for parallel and striped and other kinds of extensions for data transfer.
Okay, now is that all pretty well working out? Are there renegade or rogue standards, or is everyone really sticking to what you're doing?
Well, I don't know if I would. I think that I'm not sure I would say the renegade or rogue standards. I think that there are people that are experimenting with different kinds of technologies that are useful to distributed systems and to grid systems, and as they become proven and as people get more experience with them, we're finding that they're then bringing them into a place like GGF or IETF and saying, okay, this looks like it's useful, let's go ahead and standardize it.
So, but in fact, you're essentially the unitary forum for the integration of new ideas that people have. They essentially can work on them and then bring them to you and then propose them as standards. That's the way the process is supposed to work, and that's the way it is working. Is that?
That's the way it's working. There are other groups that, depending on the area that your standard addresses, that are like that as well. If you're working on a web services spec, chances are you're going to bring that into OASIS. If you're working on an internet protocol spec, then you're going to probably bring that into IETF. So the standards work, they're doing specifications, then related to that are these frameworks. And GGF has developed this Open Grid Services Architecture, OGSA framework, that now is layering on top of web services. But those frameworks are important because they tell us where we've got gaps in the technology that we need to, where we need to develop a specification.
Okay, but overall, it's going to be on the level of HTTP. There aren't going to be competing HTTP standards. There's going to be one, and in the same sense, there'll be a unified or unitary web services standard so that everyone can talk to everyone else, since the essence of the whole process is talking to machines talking to each other.
Yes.
Okay. Are some areas of the world more advanced in grid, Europe, the United States, Asia, other places less, South America, Africa? Are there movements afoot to create things on the order of, say, an Africa grid that would try to upgrade the economic situation there by upgrading the technology, by building grids?
Well, my observation is that the grid technology seems to be tracking internet deployment.
Right.
So where you have readily available internet services and telecommunication services, you see grid projects. So as you might expect, Europe, the U.S., Japan, Korea, and other places in Asia Pacific, Canada, these places there are lots of grid projects because the internet is very well established there. China is now doing a lot of grid projects.
In India too?
I suspect that India probably is, but I'm not familiar with what's happening there, and I don't know what their telecommunications infrastructure is.
Okay. So, in fact, are you saying that grid is more a reflection of economic development than an engine of it, or could it work the other way as well?
Well, I think it could work the other way, but at the foundation, there has to be some form of a network to build on top of.
Okay.
So without a telecommunications infrastructure, it would be difficult for grids to push things. But once you have that, then I think grids can be a factor.
So in fact, arguing that you have to have a good telecommunications structure to build a grid might be a good argument for building the telecommunications structure in the first place, in some cases, as an engine of economic growth.
I think it certainly would be a good reason to do something like that. It certainly would be a key factor.
Okay. Are there problems, important problems, that can't be solved without grids but that can be solved with grids and offer another incentive for building them and building more of them?
Well,
I
think in general what grids are... I'm not sure if I can articulate a particular problem that can't be solved without grid technology,
right.
But I can I can see and look at situations where grid technology will make a important problem easier to solve.
Okay, or faster, presumably.
Or faster to solve. And so, you know, you can always find different ways to do things. Then one question is whether grid technology can make it either much more convenient or so much easier to solve that it seems like that's the only way to do it.
All right. Then, say something in general about the economics of the grid ecology. Who is generally benefiting and who's paying? The government, private sector, consumers? Where's the money flowing around through grid projects?
Well, there's a lot of money that's coming from federal agencies where they have already invested in computing and instruments and storage and other information infrastructure. And so they're adding to that funding to take those investments and make them more useful to users,
right,
by integrating them with grid technology.
Okay.
The TerraGrid project is from NSF is it's about $100 million project, but it's leveraging about $1 billion investment in high performance computing centers.
Right.
That's just the federal investment, not the state investment. So this wave of funding has come in over the last 10 years or so, trying to use grid technology to make the existing investment in information technology more more useful to users.
How exactly is it going to make it more useful to users? Is it going to allow people at other centers to take advantage of equipment at all the other centers, and or in other ways as well?
Yeah, recently we've been thinking about, well, you know, what are some practical benefits that grid technology might bring to user or user community that is accustomed to, like the computational science community? And I remember when we first deployed Cray supercomputers that there were some things that users could do that they still would like to be able to do on clusters and on collections of clusters. So, for example, if you were in a real hurry to get your job done, you were doing a particular problem that needed to be solved within a day or two. What you could do on a Cray supercomputer was you could up your priority to get it done faster, by doing that, your allocation on that machine or the time that you had available to you would be burning faster.
Right.
So you could trade off, make a resource trade between service and your allocation.
Use up your stamps.
That's right. And what we'd like to be able to do with projects like the TerraGrid is to give users those kind of choices, or even to do things that we really haven't been able to do before that haven't been economically feasible. So, for example, there's a center at the University of Oklahoma that's run by a guy named Kelvin Drogemeyer. These guys want to be able to take sensor data about the weather and say, ooh, looks like there's going to be a really bad storm over Dallas-Fort Worth. Let's see if there's going to be a danger of tornadoes forming.
Right.
So then in order to do that, they've got to beat the weather. In order to beat the weather, they've got to take over a huge amount of computing resource. And that means that either we have to have a large number of supercomputers that sit there waiting for projects like this to use them and mostly sit there idle, or we find a more efficient way to use the machines that we have out there now.
So it's essentially cycles on demand, and they can then aggregate them all over the country or the world for a particular sudden need and use it and get what they need and then not have to pay extra to have machines sitting around doing nothing.
Right. Get in and get out, and maybe what you do during the time that they're in there is you just put everything on hold.
Right.
In the TerraGrid, we're looking at ways to do this where we might have some resources in the TerraGrid that are like flying standby, where we say, you can run on this machine, but you might get kicked off at a moment's notice for some of these on-demand guys. And if you do, we'll give you a refund of your allocation. And by the way, we're going to get to charge you one-third of the normal rate to use these machines. So you're
right.
Going to take a risk, and we'll reward your risk by charging you less.
Right.
We're still setting resources aside, but they're not sitting there idle, and yet they're still available to an on-demand application.
Right.
And, you know, that's when the technology starts to be useful to real people out there who aren't sitting in front of high-performance workstations using supercomputers. It's the person that the siren goes off in their neighborhood and they hit the basement because somebody had access to a supercomputer and said, this square mile of your city is likely to be hit by a tornado.
It's obviously less life-threatening or life-saving than tornado calculations, but is animation using grid computing an important application? Is that going to be funding some of these more esoteric activities in a way?
Well, at Argonne, we have, as part of the TerraGrid project, we have we're developing a visualization service that is meant to be a little bit of a richer service than the animation farms that that are out there now.
Right.
I think that's certainly, as you say, it's not a life-saving thing. But I can give you an example of an application where doing something like that would still be very useful in real time for somebody that, you know, doesn't work for Disney.
Right.
There's another user named Mark Ellisman who's down at UC San Diego, and he's modeling the brain and trying to give surgeons a better picture of what the brain is going to look like, not from the CAT scan where you're looking for a tumor, but when you open up to operate, the brain will swell, it will move around. And he's trying to give the surgeons a better picture of what the brain's going to look like when they're actually in the operating room.
Right.
And so for this, he's got to do this biological simulation of the brain tissue, and that's another on-demand application. Now, it's probably not something where, you know, somebody gets wheeled into the emergency room and all of a sudden they've got to take over the TerraGrid to do the operation, but to be able to plan for an operation, you'd want this sort of on-demand thing.
Right. The same way that the calculations can be done about cloud formation, they could also be done to how the various changes in one part of the brain physiology affect the other one. So.
That's right. And doing this, you know, you're not going to give the surgeon a report that's, you know, a printed piece of paper. You're going to give the surgeon an animation.
Right.
And so to be able to do what we're doing in TerraGrid is to be able to do that computation and immediately send the results to a visualization service and then to the user. That's the place where animation would be particularly useful.
You may not have to send the sample down the hall to pathology. You can look at it in real time on the screen.
Well, you can imagine that.
That's one way. What are other ways in which grid computing is going to affect ordinary people in their lives?
Well, that's a hard question.
Since they're paying for the taxes, they're paying the taxes for the.
Yeah, I think these are, you know, the weather forecasting, the being able to plan surgery. These are applications that grid technology can certainly help us move to the next phase of more computing power and being able to deal with much more realistic systems. I just don't have a very good crystal ball.
Okay. What are the main obstacles at this point for a fuller realization of grid's potential? Are they technical, economic, political, psychological, administrative?
I think there are all of those. One of the things that causes many of us to spend as much time as we do focusing on the standards is to try to address some of those. And if we can get to the point where we are today is that you can go out and you can get the, you can download a toolkit from the Globus project, or you can get a product from a company. And by the time you end up building a real operational grid, you've put a lot of sweat equity on top of that and customized it for your site so that even though you're using a standard toolkit, your grid isn't interoperable with another grid. And so as we get a more comprehensive set of standards, then a couple of things will happen that will be useful. One is I can pick and choose pieces of my grid from different suppliers, because they're going to, just as I can pick and choose internet routers today because of internet standards, I should be able to pick and choose a directory service or a single authentication, a single sign-on system. And the second is, as I do that, if you build a grid and I build a grid, at some level we can interoperate. And with the standards, we have some hope to be able to do both of those things. And without them, it'll continue to be, I build my grid, you build your grid, we put a lot of sweat equity into it, and then at the end, we don't we don't have something that can work together.
Okay. Let's talk about your relationship with the GGF. What would you say the major accomplishments have been during your time there?
Well, I'd say there's a handful of us that have been in GGF from the very beginning.
Which was when was the very beginning?
Well, the very beginning was we actually did a Birds of a Feather session at a conference in November of 1998. So Ian Foster and Bill Johnston and a number of other folks got together and said, would it make sense for us to form some sort of a forum? As we've been thinking during that year of 1998, we've been thinking about, does the middleware community need an IETF, need a place where people can come together and do standards, because we knew we were going to need standards at the middleware layer.
Right. Tell people what middleware is.
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but when we say middleware, we are really talking about the software that sits above the network layer. So it's not necessarily TCP or IP or HTTP, but it's also below the application. So by middleware, I mean directory services or file movement services, replication of databases, things like that.
Is it delivery of web of grids, web services fall into the middleware category?
I think a lot of people would probably say web services are an example of middleware.
Okay.
But you know, middleware is maybe an outdated term at this point.
Is there a new term coming up?
Well, I think grid technology has taken the place of middleware.
Okay.
In the vocabulary.
All right.
So we've been doing this now for about 5 years, and I think a couple of things stand out to me as things that I feel good about us accomplishing. One is that we actually did create a community, and it's a very the community is very much alive and dynamic, and we have people that regularly work together and are just moving things forward together in a cooperative way, where there was no place for that community to happen before. I think as part of that, we've been able to construct something that doesn't just it's not just the supercomputing people. It's the commercial computing people. It's the end users from biology as well as the end users from physics, and it's even financial people. So this community is a rather broad one, and when I tell people, as we often do a introductory session at a GGF meeting for new people, I say, well, you're going to find people here who do grid research, software research, computer scientists. You're going to find end users of grid technology. You're going to find software developers, and you're going to find people who deploy grids. So this community, I think, is one of the accomplishments of the GGF. The people that started GGF, myself and others. I think that along with that, we have been able to bootstrap a standards process that is both new and compatible with other standards activities is an accomplishment. We went to the Internet Engineering Task Force early on and we said we want to be able to create these standards. We want to do it in a way that's either part of you or collaborative with you. And because IETF at that time was dealing with explosive growth themselves, they said, well, why don't you start an effort and we'll help you do it in such a way that it plays nicely with the Internet standards. And so that's what we did. So we bootstrapped this standards process. We changed it a little bit with advice from some of the experienced IETF people that if they had it to do over again, they would do it this way as opposed to that way. And now that's a standards body that's been able to take the needs of this community and translate it into specifications and standards. The recent Web Services Notification and Web Services Resource Framework work was the result of about a year of interactions between the Web Services community and the GGF community, who had done OGSA, and we were talking about grid services. We were all concerned that the grid community would diverge from the commercial community because some of the things that we wanted as part of grid services were not on the radar screen of the web services community, and some of them were just crossways to the way they thought about how web services ought to look from an architecture standpoint.
So how was that resolved?
Well, it was resolved by some people spending a whole lot of time together to get discussions going between the web services community and the GGF community. And in the end, the web services notification and the web services resource framework, these two specifications have taken large pieces of the grid services and embedded them into web services. So the resolution is that we've been able to influence the grid community, have been able to influence the commercial web services folks to add some things that we needed so that now we can ride directly on top of commercial web services and don't have to invent our own plumbing.
Well, that sounds like it would be good for both sides. What have been the major frustrations for you, administratively or technically?
You mean just in general as GGF has gone from over the last 5 years?
Yes.
Well, I personally didn't set out to. I thought I would keep GGF going long enough that it would survive past what I used to say. I want it to last beyond the initial enthusiasm. People get together, this looks like it'll be interesting, but after, a year or two, oftentimes things sort of fizzle out.
Right.
I think that we're past that point, and we've got a self-sustaining amount of momentum, but it was a lot more work than I thought it would be.
Right.
And what started out as something I was doing on the side quickly started to take over.
So was the fact that you realized that things looked like they had their own momentum now figure in your decision to step down as president, or were there other reasons?
Well, there were a number of things that caused me to say, it's time for someone else to come in and lead this thing. And one of them was, quite frankly, I'll have been doing it for 5 years in October, and one of the things that I worked for Larry Smarr at NCSA for 15 years, and he used to say, the key to knowing whether you've succeeded as a leader is that the person who takes the person's place, who takes your place, has a successful enterprise. So the person who takes my place is the second GGF chair, and the person who takes their place will let me know, according to Larry's rules, whether we did things right. I think that leadership turning over at the top is a good thing, and after 5 years, I felt like it was time that we bring some new blood in, some new ideas at the top level. One of the things that convinced me that now was the right time to do it, and that was really practically speaking a good strategy for GGF, is that we did that last year with our steering group. For the first time in the steering group, we began to cycle people out and new people in through a community-driven search process. We got 5 new people on the steering group who came in with such an energy and enthusiasm that the rest of the steering group looked at each other and went, "Oh man, we got to pick it up a notch."
Right.
So the healthy impact of new blood at the steering group level told me, "Gee, wouldn't it be great if we had some healthy new blood in at the chair, at the level of the chair?"
Right.
So as so I've been looking at that for a while. Another factor is, 2 full-time jobs is too much for anybody to handle, and this had grown into a full-time job, and I already had a full-time job.
Right. What's your other full-time job?
Well, I work for Argonne National Laboratory, and I'm a senior fellow there, and so I'm working on the TerraGrid project, and I didn't feel like I was able to give the TerraGrid project what it deserved, and I didn't feel like I was giving the GGF what it deserved. And so it was really time, two non-full-time jobs that were handleable 3 years ago had become two very demanding full-time jobs.
Now, you're going to be retaining some titles and duties at GGF, though, aren't you?
Well, I am going to continue working with GGF. Originally, I thought, well, I'll stay on as the editor.
Right. And the editor, editor of what?
The editor of the document or standards series.
Right, okay.
And because that's actually one of the more fun things that I do there. But the more that I've looked at the number of documents that are coming in and the amount of work that really needs to happen to do that correctly, I've become convinced that we need to get somebody to do that as a focused activity as well.
That's another full-time job.
That's another full-time job. And, you know, again, it wasn't 2 years ago, but it will be by the end of this year. So we're also looking for an editor. What I will continue to do, though, is to participate in the steering group, which is the management group of GGF, and for at least a year of overlap with the new GGF chair, and as long as they'll have me, I am still interested in helping GGF. I would just like to join the rest of the folks as a volunteer and make room for someone else in the chair and the editor in the editor role.
Did you get paid as a GGF chair?
No. No.
Okay. They paying for your hotel room there in Rhode Island now?
Well, so as far as finances go, GGF, we had to start a not-for-profit company to handle the finances and the contracts that have to do with putting on meetings for 600 or 700 people. And so GGF paid for my expenses of travel and things like that were related to GGF, but aside from being able to participate in free dinners with program committees and things like that,
right.
I don't think I've never had to report any GGF income on my tax returns.
Okay, what's the timetable for picking the new chair?
We are working. We've got a search committee that is essentially our steering group, and that's being led by Dennis Gannon from Indiana University, Ian Foster from U of Chicago and Oregon, Ian Baird from Platform Computing, and Pete Clark from the University College London. These four guys are actively talking to candidates and bringing data in, and then the whole steering group will make a recommendation on the next chair. I wish I could tell you who they're talking to. We've got one guy in particular that I'm doing my best to twist his arm to do it, because he would be a great person to take the job. If we can find somebody by the meeting in June, then we'll go ahead and announce them and get them on board. But the target is to make sure that we have somebody in place by October.
So the steering group will be the people deciding on the new chair?
Yeah, the way that that we set this process up before this even came up, several years ago, and we were writing out bylaws and things like that, the steering group is responsible to select the GGF chair, because nominally this is a three-year nomination or three-year term.
Right.
So the steering group is responsible for making a recommendation to our external advisory committee, we call the GFAC, the Global Grid Forum Advisory Committee.
Right.
The advisory committee, these are high-level people. Paul Messina is the chair of the advisory committee. We've got vice president and corporate officer level people from several companies there, as well as leaders from laboratories and government agencies. And it's ultimately their role to approve the next GGF chair or to ask the steering group to go back and try again.
So essentially the steering group will present their choice to the advisory committee. The advisory committee will okay them.
That's right.
Or not, and send it back.
That's right.
For another one. Okay. And you're hoping that might be done by June?
Yes, that's our hope.
Okay. Last sort of closing questions here. What do you see as the further reaches of GRID? What kind of things do you think that the creation of better, faster, bigger grids will eventually be able to do that can't be done anywhere in any way now?
Well, that's another crystal ball question.
Right.
It's hard. I think that what we're going to be seeing is the where the grid community is really able to make the best impact is in the solution space, and that is not necessarily developing the low level specs like web services, although we do some of those things, but taking that plumbing that we call it, the plumbing of web services, and thinking about how you would couple resources together to do new kinds of science or new kinds of applications.
Well,
or
when you say web services, what's included in that?
Well, I mean mostly things that are, the simplest way to say it is services that are specified through web services description language, or WSDL.
Right.
The W3C.
And for examples of those would be?
Well, in the OGSA world, for example, we've got some efforts to define specific services that would be offered as web services, although this is a grid service, but offered as web services. So, for example, we've got Norm Patton from University of Manchester and Dave Pearson from Oracle have been leading a working group that is defining a web or grid services, OGSA, interface for database services. So a way to put a database on the web and or on the grid and allow people to interface with it. And some of the folks at the within the UK eScience initiative and specifically the center at Edinburgh have put some code together that implements that specification. It's going to be included in I'm told by the Globus folks that they're including this database service based on the GGF spec in the next version of the Globus toolkit. So that's an example of a service that could be offered, and that is access to a database. Another example would be a particular application service. Within the TerraGrid, we're talking to commercial application providers about offering a application service so a user can show up and upload their data files and run the application and then download the results.
So that could be, for example, to give them an antivirus protection service or an anti-spam service that would then call on the power of the grid to deliver the calculations necessary to deliver that to a particular end user.
Yeah, you can imagine a service like that, or you could imagine offering a financial analysis grid service where I upload my portfolio, I choose a number of different market factors that might or might not happen, or
or my preferences for growth versus risk. Or
sure,
whatever.
And you might by packaging the risk analysis software that today only financial professionals can get to.
Right.
Rather than paying a financial professional to do that for me, I might just give my credit card and for $20 get a personalized portfolio forecast.
Right. Okay. So then those are all grid services or web services.
Yeah, people have asked me, well, I think that the grid is going to have the same impact on society as the web did, and my answer is always, I'm not sure we're going to see another thing like the web, another phenomenon like that, but I do think that grid technology will, for the average person out there, they'll see services that to them are just new services on the web that are powered by grid technology in the back end.
Right. It might not be as revolutionary as the car, but it would be as revolutionary as fuel injection or something.
Sure.
Okay. Last question, intimate, personal. Why do you care about grid? Why do you do grid things?
Why do I care about grids and do grid things? Well, I think at several levels. I personally like to help groups of people work together. I like to form teams. I like to form communities and get communities working together. And so GGF has been, for me, a fun project to that end. And so I look and I see a community that's formed. In OGSA, we had 60 companies come together and cooperate on an architecture, whereas 3 years ago we couldn't get two people in the same room from even the same company that could agree on even the need for an architecture. So personally, I like that human aspect. There's another level of me that just likes the technology, but bringing those two things together, the kind of applications that that motivate me are those kind of applications that have use for people who maybe don't even realize that they're benefiting from grid technology, whether that's somebody that I used the severe storm example earlier. That sort of thing, saving people's lives like that, is motivating. Some of the drug research. So to me, it's the technology that tends to impact beating hearts that's motivating.
Okay, in fact, you've brought people together to create a technology that brings machines together that may, in fact, bring people together. So you've got a sort of trifecta there. So
yeah, that's kind of a fun way to put it, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time, all this information, and hopefully more people will learn more about GRID by listening to this, and I look forward to talking to you and other GRID people there going forward as well.
Okay, Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Bye.